Dive in. So I'm Rick Hansen, and this is July 28th, correct? 2010. And to set the stage a little bit, just a reminder, this year we set out to really investigate mindfulness, or what is in Buddhism one of the three primary pillars of practice, in the traditional language of the earliest surviving written record, Pali. Those three pillars are known as sila, samadhi, and panya, or sometimes translated virtue, concentration, or mindfulness in wisdom. So we're focused on the second of those three pillars. They're all co-equal. They're all very, very important. And a lot of the practical advice that the Buddha gave, both for daily life as well as for contemplative practice, focused on the second pillar of practice, the mindfulness pillar. So, as an organizing impetus for that investigation this year, we've been working with the, I would say, probably single most famous Buddha sutta, the Satipatthana Sutta, the four applications or four foundations or four establishings of mindfulness. Right? Those four are, first, the body, which we've spent the first half of this year working with. Second, the feeling tone of experience, moment to moment, as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. Third, basic states of mind as either wholesome or unwholesome. And fourth, the fourth application of mindfulness, the fourth domain that one is to be mindful of, are major themes in Buddhism, like the five aggregates or aspects of experience, or the awakening factors. This is where you'll find a lot of the famous Buddhist lists, the seven awakening factors, the five aggregates, the five hindrances, the four noble truths, and all the rest of that. Okay. So we've kind of made a bit of a, we've been making a transition from the first foundation of mindfulness, the body, to the second one, the feeling tones of experience, or the, as they're known in psychology in the West, the hedonic tones, as pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And coming off of the month of June, much of which I was on retreat, I talked about embodiment, relinquishment, love, and last week, the sacred, kind of a rocket blast from my retreat. I thought I'd share with you. And today I would like to really start getting into the investigation of feeling tones, which are really critical to everyday upsets and everyday well-being. In other words, the nitty-gritty of happiness or suffering in daily life really depends a lot on how we react to the moment-to-moment signal in the brain, as it were, and in the mind, therefore, of whether something is pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. So to go there, today I want to focus mainly on what we do when something seems rewarding, is pleasant, or when we anticipate a reward, or, very interestingly, when we want something that actually really isn't very rewarding at all. So, and this is where I think that modern psychology and modern neuropsychology can really inform and extend these marvelous teachings that were developed 2,500 years ago and refined since, but can, add to those teachings in ways that I think are actually quite powerful and useful in daily life, as well as quite interesting. And so I'm going to, and this is an area where I think there's some particular contributions that psychology and neurology can make, and I'll be talking about those tonight. Also, to spare my voice, I intend to do some experiential activities, clever fellow that I am, that also have the value, which is a wonderful value, of encouraging your own investigation as well as building a growing sense of community here. And among the Buddhist lists are the three jewels, the teacher, the teaching, and the community of the taught. And there are three jewels in Buddhism, not just two. Okay, so to think about this, the Buddha was, and we are as well, very interested in suffering as well as in happiness. And by suffering or happiness, we certainly can mean very extreme forms of either suffering or joy. But most of what we mean really is the everyday business of mild happiness, mild peacefulness, mild satisfaction, mild fulfillment, or mild discomfort, mild loneliness, mild sorrow, mild anxiety, mild shame, and mild anger. Right? That's the territory, isn't it, that where we spend most of our days. So in terms of that world, the Buddha was very interested in causes. A fundamental meta model, if you will, within Buddhism is processes and causes. That was the Buddha's radical contribution, which predated quantum mechanics and other postmodern Western views by 2,500 years, yet has been shown to be very powerful and very accurate. Everything flows and changes, and what arises is due to preceding causes. So the Buddha spent a fair amount of time working backwards. So let's say he starts with suffering. Suffering. What causes suffering? Right? The first noble truth is what? It's the truth of suffering. It's the fact of suffering. It's not that all of life is nothing but suffering, but rather there is suffering. And a fair amount of it, isn't there? Okay? So there is suffering. What causes suffering? That's where the second noble truth comes in. The Buddha asserted, and you should see for yourself, that craving causes suffering. Right? Desire, craving, although technically craving has a particular meaning to it that is a little distinct from desire, although they're often used synonymously. For example, as we'll see, desires can move through the mind, but if they don't find root, they don't tip into craving. It's when we fertilize our desires and get invested in them and identified with them and feed them with the Buddhist words, the nutriments. I think of this fertilizer, you know, tons of sugar, right? Just get those desires bubbling away. That's when they really, really take root. And that's actually very hopeful, to allow the possibility of desires flowing through awareness, because as animals, we desire, you know. Drop a brick on the foot of a Buddha, he'll want, or she will want, that brick to be moved, you know. The Dalai Lama wants, you know, freedom for the people of Tibet, or at least political autonomy, right? We have desires for the welfare of our children. These are okay. It's when they invade the mind and remain. That's the phrase of the Buddha. Invade the mind and remain. You know, like Bermuda grass. There's a guy who pulled a lot of weeds growing up in Southern California. When Bermuda grass invades your lawn, oh boy, you are in deep trouble. Okay? So, long story short, what causes desire in the Buddha's view is craving. What causes craving? In the analysis of the Buddha, with the fancy bit of rhetoric called the chain of dependent origination, the preceding cause of craving is the feeling tone, pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And based on that feeling tone, we crave the continuance and the expansion of what's pleasant, right? And we crave the ending or decrease of what's unpleasant. And then what causes the feeling tone? In the Buddha's analysis, it's what he called contact, the meeting of an object, a sense object, and that includes the sixth sense objects of mind, a sense faculty, like sight or thought, and a sense consciousness, like auditory awareness, visual awareness, or inner conceptual awareness. Right? Now here's the interesting thing. If you think about that causal chain working backwards, there's a little problem with it. In that, just because something precedes something else doesn't mean it caused it. Or, for example, that, you know, if A precedes B, maybe A is necessary for B. But is A sufficient for B? In other words, just because A arises doesn't mean that B will always arise. In other words, without getting philosophical here about it, let's take two kinds of examples. All right? Example one is you've had a really full meal and you just feel really complete and you feel emotionally complete. It's been a very satisfying meal with friends. You're emotionally full. Your belly's full. Everything's good. You've had everything you ever, you know, wanted. You're just fine. And let's also say that there is a particular food that you really find pleasant. You like a lot. Good chocolate truffle, nice orange. Think about your favorite foods, all right? Pizza, meatballs, whatever it is, okay? And here you are at dinner. You're completely full. And someone takes a little bit of that food, a friend, let's say, and surprises you and says, open your, close your eyes, open your mouth, and puts it on your tongue. It would be pleasant, wouldn't it? You would like it, wouldn't you? Would you necessarily want more of it? Maybe, maybe not. Often people don't. If you fill people up on something, they would say, yes, it still tastes good. I like chocolate truffles. It still tastes really good. I like that exotic mushroom with garlic and da-da. But I actually, no thanks, I'm good. I don't want any more of that. All right? That's an example where something is pleasant, but it alone is not sufficient to cause craving. Isn't that interesting right there? Let's take a different example. Let's take the example of something that is not particularly pleasant. People would not say is pleasant. For example, people pulling on a slot machine. All right? In Vegas. Have you ever seen people just repetitively pull the slots? Maybe you've been there yourself, I don't know. It's very interesting, my own experience, of watching people pull the slots. It's eerie, actually, to watch their faces. They're either blank or stressed and weary and bored and kind of desperate and upset, right? And yet there they are, pulling the slot machine over and over and over again. They want it, but it's not particularly pleasant. For example, drug addicts often will crave, in other words, they will want a drug that doesn't get them high particularly. They just find that they want it. Right? So there too, we can have craving without necessarily a pleasant feeling tone that precedes it. And I think a lot of the time, we actually tip into craving not really based on anything that's pleasant in the moment. Sometimes we tip into craving based on anticipatory vedanas. Vedanas are the Pali term for the feeling tones. Anticipatory pleasures, anticipated rewards. The mind in the simulator fabricates, okay, if I have that cookie, if I pull that lever, you know, something good will come my way. And you can see that in the mind. But very often, isn't it actually also true that there isn't even that? There's just this automatic compulsion. I find that for myself in certain regards. I just kind of automatically think I ought to do something, right? I ought to eat this or drive that way or get some more chips or, you know, put the dishes here rather than there, kind of out of my own OCD-ish automatic orderliness, which makes my family just laugh hysterically when they watch Dad just, I'm like a chelator of disorder. I just sweep through my house, you know, extracting chaos, you know, counterentropically. But anyway, the point, ding, 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 is I wouldn't even say it's particularly rewarding, but I'm on autopilot, right? Don't we spend a fair amount of our time on autopilot?
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
So here we are, right? We get caught up in these states of craving, which actually don't have necessarily a lot of rewards. They aren't necessarily that pleasant. And as a result, there's a certain quality of what? A kind of contraction, a drivenness, a pursuit of things, looking for love in all the wrong places. By the way, that's a major area of, you know, wanting without liking. If you think about liking and wanting and kind of decoupling them from each other, you can imagine things that we like a lot or like very little, and then things we want a lot or want very little. It gives you a 2x2 matrix, right? So you can imagine the quadrant of the stuff that we like a lot and want a lot. There's a lot of drivenness there, right? But what about the category that we said? And then if we don't like it or want it, that's pretty simple. We kind of let that one go. But what about the category of we like but don't crave? Or we crave, but don't particularly like. I mean, liking without craving, some people consider that heaven. I think that's a lot the mind of a Buddha. And that's our own mind, when we're in a state of centeredness and spaciousness and a basic underlying core is established of contentment and well-being, right? Pleasures can move through the mind. We enjoy them, just as you were getting at. You know, and desires can even arise in the mind, and they're okay. But we don't get all caught up in it. Right? We don't activate this whole cascade of wanting, craving, grasping, reaching, musting, insisting. On the other hand, the state of wanting without liking is considered by some to be hell. Right? That's the person pulling the slot machine. That's the drug addict just needing that extra fix, even though it hardly moves the needle at all. You know, that's the person who's washing their hands for the 50th time that day, who feels compelled to do it, even though there's no reward value in it. So what to do about all this? Right? First, I think expanding this traditional sequence of, you know, the feeling tone leads to craving, leads to suffering, is really pretty useful. Right? And you start to see, wait a second here, it's a bigger picture than that. You know, it's more complex than that. There's a whole territory where I can like things that are pleasant without it tipping into craving and therefore suffering. Alternately, I can get caught up in craving things for which there's really not much sense of pleasant. Right? So before I go into the next part, which is a particular practice and kind of insight I've had, I guess, about this whole machinery, why don't we pause for a second and see if there are any questions or comments so far. And where it really works is to try to bring it down to your own life. You know? Yeah.
When just from when you were starting to talk about this, I was thinking about there are categories of like instincts that it attaches to, like food. You know, when the instinct is present, then there's the desire, and then all the articulation of types of food and all this whole aesthetic thing. And that would probably be true for other drives, you know. But I'm just wondering how you would, you know, sort of break it down and, you know, what are more primary or what do we really want kind of thing? We want to be happy. I mean, I guess you're going to get to this, but I was just thinking that these come up in a way, but, you know, there's more of a root desire to be happy, I think. And it seems like the Buddhist thing is sorting through all this in a way and seeing where what leads to happiness.
Right.
And what that is. What is happiness?
Yeah.
Happiness. That's always a question that, you know.
Yeah.
Interesting. So.
Thank you. I kind of bounce off your question a little bit, is to highlight the degree to which Buddhism is full of wanting. Mm-hmm. All right? It's just that it's the right kind of wanting. It's the wanting that leads to happiness and the end of suffering. Buddhism, just as you again, I think very well said, pointed out, it's not anti-desire, right? The desire for awakening is a very, very wholesome desire, right? The desire to support the awakening of others. You know, we start our sitting with me saying something I heard from a teacher I respect a lot. You know, may our practice help free beings from suffering and its causes. Beings including ourselves. You know? So yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. The trick, of course, and the art, to me at least, is to work with the caveman, cavewoman brain that's deeply organized around lust and thirst and appetite, you know, and primal emotional reactions, the inner iguana, the inner monkey, the inner squirrel. Work with that character in there without shaming yourself, with compassion for it. Poor caveman, you know. I actually read recently they've actually sequenced the genome of Neanderthals, and about 4% of human DNA, particularly Caucasians and Asians for various reasons, 1 to 4% is Neanderthal DNA. You know, it's in our blood, right? So the trick is to work with this, you know, these primal qualities that want things, and use the movements of wanting in ways that are wholesome and positive without getting captured by them. That's the trick, isn't it? Without turning it into needing and musting and insisting, then we get caught because we've lost our freedom. In other words, how can we have desire, how can we have an open mind and an animal body in which desire arises, which is surrounded with freedom? Right? That's a very real question, isn't it? Particularly when we live as householders and we have to make decisions 100 times a day. You know, Starbucks or Jamba Juice? Gap or Macy's? Right? Shopping Channel or, you know, KQED, whatever, right? We have to make these choices many times a day. Right. So I want to talk about something that I think is actually very, very, very promotive of that freedom of spaciousness that can hold desire moving through the mind and can engage positive desires without getting carried, without getting trapped by them. And that factor is gratitude. Because when we're already grateful for what we have, for what there is in our life, that immediately calms that inner lizard, you know, the inner squirrel or monkey or caveman or woman, right? Gratitude. The felt sense of already being given combined with a sense, with an attitude of thankfulness. Do you see how that works? That immediately calms things down. And in a context of always already being grateful, then one looks at these various desires and asks oneself, is that really going to reward me? I'll give you a little example, then let's do something experiential. I was at Starbucks on my way here, just wolfing down some food and getting a little caffeine shot so I wouldn't fall asleep in front of you tonight, which would be quite embarrassing. I'll tell you this free associating story. You know, when I'm a little ill, I free associate more, for better or for worse. I did the S training, you know, in many, many decades ago, as well as a lot of other things. So I assisted in some of the S workshops, which were very intense, very hardcore, if you never did them. And I was in a children's training, which was really, really hardcore, and tends to really reactivate a lot of material. So people who are already on the logistics team and getting only about 2 to 4 hours of sleep a night for something like 4 or 5 days in a row, assisting, volunteering at this training, okay, for the value in it, me included, we're also dealing with all the stuff that gets stirred up with these kids sharing about their lives and so forth. So the way it works is that it's as if, how can I put this, you are the audience turned around the other way, you're the kids, and there's the trainer in the front, and I'm kind of here, and behind me is a table with three people sitting at it who are running the show. Suddenly there's this loud banging sound like that, which is just anathema in the S training. And we all kind of quickly turn around like, what in the world is that, right? And we look back and everybody in the back table is sitting perfectly upright. Yet our logistics supervisor has a spot of red slowly growing in his forehead, not blood, but inflammation. He had fallen asleep. Bam! And smacked his poor head. And, you know, the worst of it for him wasn't the pain, it was the embarrassment, you know? And so, anyway, I don't want to go there. So, that's why I was at Starbucks. Now, but there is an allegory here. So there I was, I had my sandwich, and I spied this yummy-looking pastry. All right? Now, I'm not that much of a sucker for pastries, but that one looked pretty darn good. I think it was one of these sort of lemon cake things with frosting and a nice looking there, thick, gooey, you know, right? And then I thought to myself, maybe I should practice what I'm going to preach tonight and look inside. And I just noticed that I was already kind of full. I'd already had a sandwich and I was okay. I just opened up to a basic sense of gratitude for being alive, being at Starbucks, having my coffee, it's all right, I'm going to get to be with you all later tonight, you know, in my mind. It's going okay, sun is shining, no bombs going off, you know, cars are not exploding in the street. Really, you can find a lot of reasons to be grateful, you know. I got 2 legs, 2 arms, 2 eyes, 2 ears, still seems to be working upstairs okay, you know, a lot to be grateful for, etc. And then in that context, did I still want that pastry? Nah, I could do without it. And, you know, the desire for it really abated, and then what became clear were the costs of it, which include the fact that I'm allergic to wheat, So it wouldn't be that good an idea to eat it anyway. You see, prior gratitude helps turn the heat down, if you will, on these hot desires. So let's explore gratitude for a moment. So I invite you, if you will, to get a partner in a second, which will have a double benefit of helping you get to know other people better. I encourage you maybe find someone you don't know well or haven't have not partnered up with before in the past. Pick an A and a B. A's will go first. The structure, as usual, is a speaker and a listener. And for about 3 minutes, I'm asking you now, to speak about, talk about what you're grateful for, particularly among the people in your life, among your relationships, right? Both past and present, but particularly present. Okay? And then I'll give you a signal, and about 3 minutes are up. You'll switch roles. A's will mainly listen then, B's will mainly talk. Then I'll ring the bell again. And then I'll ask you to find a new partner, and there'll be a second thing to explore gratitude for. Okay, and then we'll come back and talk about it for a few minutes. All right, willing to try this? You can always sit it out. You don't have to do it. All right? It's probably good for you to do it. Okay, find a partner if you could. Pick an A and a B. If you want a partner and do not have one, raise your hand. Partner, anybody want a partner? Great. Pick an A and a B. A's, begin. You want to be my partner?
I should.